Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This week's episode of the Bass Guitar Nerds podcast is sponsored by Ashdown Engineering, a British bass amplification powerhouse whose gear is seen on the biggest stages in the world, backing up the biggest bands in the world. But now Ashdown have expanded their expertise into bass guitars. Having teamed up with master luthier Dan Lackin, previously of Lackland Basses, Ashdown are now offering five different models of US-designed basses, from classically inspired shapes to completely new designs, fusing vintage sensibilities with all the modern applications a bassist needs. Available in an ever-expanding range of finishes, and all for under £1,000. These instruments are extremely exciting. Check them out at ashdownmusic.com or follow links in the description of this podcast. Hello and welcome to the Bass Guitar Nerds podcast, a podcast by guitar nerds. I am your host, Joe Branton, joined this week by JD Short.
Hello.
And Naomi McLeod.
Hello.
Hello. Yes, that's right. So we cut Mark Packham out this week because we realised that, you know, he could only really talk about one thing, and he spoke about that last week. So we'd exhausted all of his bass guitarness, and we thought we'd focus on... yeah, the expert. So we had a great sort of first episode of the Bass Guitar Nerds. I was totally chuffed with all the wonderful feedback we'd had from the community over on, you know, especially on Facebook at facebook.com/groups/guitar nerds forum if you want to join that, listener, if you don't already. But yes, it was an excellent first episode, and we got to talk about JD and Naomi, your kind of basses. So we talked, you know, a lot about JD's Stonefield, and we talked a lot about Naomi's Bronco, your heavily customized Bronco, which was super cool. But this week I'd popped a little post in the Facebook group asking if anyone had any questions, and we got such great ones that I thought we could maybe focus on some of those. But first of all, kind of before we go into any of that, I thought we'd talk about, you know, I guess the things that we've been up to this week in the bass world. JD, I know that your gear is actually finally getting here soon.
Yeah, it'll be exciting. So it is now in the country and off of its shipment container. So just waiting for delivery. So it's exciting to be reunited with cases and cases of pedals.
I guess that's the bulk of it. How many basses are coming over as well?
So I have one electric with me, my Stonefield, M series. I have the F series that's been with the upgraded stuff that's coming. I have another custom bass that I had built by Jack Reed, which is a 5-string with 20 different woods and piezos and magnetic pickups and all sorts of fun stuff. And then I also have my NS upright coming over.
Oh, so really? You have an NS design upright? That's pretty cool.
Yeah, so I have that, which I almost brought that on the plane, but that's because it's easier to travel with than just a regular electric bass. Like the gig bag that it comes with is smaller and easier to transport than an electric bass and like a mono bag or any of those. Yeah, super dope.
Yeah, very cool. I'd love to. I always really liked the NS design. They did
like this range of, what were they called? Radius was the name of the series.
Oh yeah, yeah, like they're electric, like those. I would say like that was, for a long time I hadn't really picked up a bass that I really caught my attention, but probably about 5-6 years ago when they came out with those, or maybe more, but I played one of those at the Bass Player Live in Hollywood, which is sort of the one of the shows that Bass Player Magazine used to put on, and was just in their booth like playing it, and it was, they sound so good, and it was one of the best playing basses I've ever had. Like, it's just really, really smooth and buttery, and like it's probably, if I were to get something, it's they would be on my list of something to have. I think it's just such a good, I really like their, like all their stuff.
Yeah, they're high up on my list as well. I think the NS design, for listeners who don't know, so that's, it's obviously, it's Ned Steinberg design basses, and they are headless, surprisingly, but a slightly more conventional shape, like a normal shape with an extended upper horn that sits over the 12th frets. You know, it's going to sit on you in the same way that a Fender does. And then a really great, interesting job of the bridge, with this kind of large, seemingly floating, but it's actually connected single piece bridge that actually works very well and is quite old school in many ways, and a single active pickup bang in the middle of the body. So it's actually, you know, for an incredibly modern instrument, it's actually super simple. And they're not too much money either. They're sub £1,000. And I think you can get them on, you can get them through Bass Direct. I think Bass Direct in the UK stock them on, you know, I'm sure they're available everywhere in the US, but
yeah.
You know, they're like, it's a really good price for, you know, a kind of legendary bass luthier who, you know, who's come back with some really interesting models. It's kind of a great, like, classic meets modern sort of thing.
Yeah, I really like them. And they have, like, there's another, like, a higher end of those series that I think are roughly around, last time I looked, I think you can probably get them for around 2,500 US, I think, locally, for, like, the more handcrafted versions of those. But yeah, like, they're definitely worth checking out, or if you can... If you can, you know, if you see one when there are shops that are open and whatnot.
Yeah. 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 Is it the NXT series that you have as an upright?
Yes. Yeah. So mine is the NXT. So they have the NXT-A, which is active, which is also, because Ned's an engineer, is one of those, like, you charge it from a quarter inch jack.
Right.
You basically plug a quarter inch jack into it and it charges the internal battery. And it's just, you know, like one of those, like, super simple, fascinating bits of electro magic. And but mine's just passive. So it's just a passive upright, but it's.
Wait, so like a passive piezo then?
Yep.
Oh, right.
Well, yes. Yeah. I mean, there's nothing to plug in, but so it's, impedance wise, I usually run it through some stuff, but it's, you know, like a decent clean DI signal and stuff from it. But yeah, it's, that's all it is, really.
Yeah.
Pretty simple, straightforward. Cool.
Yeah. Naomi, do you play upright at all?
I don't yet. No, I haven't delved. It's something I've intended doing for a long time, but, I suppose haven't had the time or the gig perhaps that has necessitated learning.
Yeah.
I would love to though. How about yourself, Joe?
No, I suck at it. I suck at it. So back at
that's not the attitude.
I play fretless a lot because I'm
cool.
You know, no good at double bass.
Right. Okay.
I can't get I love everything about the look of double bass, but it's weird that it gets lumped so much into the same thing. And obviously, you know, JD, you play both, but for me, they're just such a million miles away from each other, like sonically, that there isn't so much that I like about a double bass sound in you know, in lots of ways. It's such a difficult instrument to apply to lots of genres, and so I think, you know, I go through phases of being really into it and then sort of not being into it at all. I'd love to learn to play the guitarra, the mariachi bass, the big six string thing.
With
9 frets. I'd love to be able to play one of those. That's been on my list for a little while. There was a company that I can't remember who now, so no, not good, not good podcasting. But there was a company that reissued, did them as a kind of a really sort of modern electric version that you could, you know, that would be great for normal bass players to learn on.
Okay.
I always meant to get one, but I've not got round to it yet. That will be my next thing, I
think.
Nice.
Not that it's any direct replacement whatsoever, but what are your thoughts on the U-bass?
The U-basses actually sound great. The Carla U-basses. Yeah, mm-hmm. They really easy to play because they, you know, they play like a fretless. That you get mm-hmm. those great big rubber strings on them. I actually think they sound really good. I think the problem is that there's a lot of price points.
Isn't there?
And if you pick up the basic one, you know, surprisingly, it's not going to play very well or sound very good. Mm-hmm. But you know, you get the better quality ones, and they're really good. One thing that I found takes some getting used to is tuning.
Right. Is that because of the silicone strings that they're that much softer that it's more sensitive or?
It's a million turns to get a slight adjustment because of the nature of the material of the strings. So it's one of those things that we had one like just sitting around it back when I was at GAC. It was just sitting in our office. So it was the sort of thing we picked up and played every now and again. Mm-hmm. It sounded great. But when it went out of tune, like it took me ages to realize that I was like, oh, these tuners don't work. And then we eventually realized that they do. It's just it's going to take you 5 minutes to get back in tune. So I don't know if they'd have some issues for sort of live application, but then I guess they're really designed for studio application, for small studios that can't necessarily fit a double bass, you know, for that one song that you need a double bass for.
So what you're saying is it wouldn't necessarily fit the polymath bill.
yeah, exactly that. But they do have some cool ones. I'm looking at them now on bassdirect.co.uk.
Yeah, have you seen the Journey? Like,
oh, that's exactly what I'm looking
The one I keep looking at. Like, there's a, what is it, like a red one or like an orange one that sort of looks like that. What was the Chet Atkins Gibson?
Yeah.
You know, like that kind of orangey thing, like the Tennessee Gentleman, whatever that model is. But
yeah, but
like it's, or it's just, it's, it has like the F holes on it and everything. Like,
yeah. Yeah. So no, yeah. F holes instead of a sort of a, you know, the normal sound hole in the middle. And yeah, the one I'm looking at is like, is black with a gorgeous white binding on it.
Yeah. I was going to ask about the binding. Yeah.
Yeah. It's great. That's a load of fun. I would say, listener, if you've not played one, they are tons of fun. They're like £400 for like a top end one. And you can get them fretted or fretless, you know, if you want to be lazy, but you know, they're, but they are really good. I think those 21 inch scales are probably better than the 20 inch scales. I imagine that makes them a bit better, but yeah
I'd say tonally there's probably a little more going on. There is also, sorry, not to derail this entirely, seeing as we asked about double bass, but there are some interesting variations on it that I'm pretty certain have come out long since the Carla U bass from Gold Tone. They do a micro bass which has the same silicone strings, and they even do a solid version, the ME bass, which is a 23 inch scale, which sits around the kind of £500 mark. And that is well worth checking out if you're feeling into this silicone string but fretted vibe for that strange...
What was the company? Gold Tone.
Gold Tone, yeah. Gold Tone. They produce really nice folk instruments, acoustics, that sort of thing, in the, you know, the budget range. Like, I believe most of their instruments would sit under the, well under the £1,000 mark. But yeah, check out their micro bass 25 and micro 23, I think. But if the Carla U bass is just that bit too small, but you're after that tone,
yeah,
these are an interesting choice.
yeah, totally worth a look. Yeah, I definitely prefer those sort of things to, you know, was it Taylor that released, I think they actually also called it the micro bass. I can't remember exactly. The acoustic bass that they released that was like a...
The GSE Mini bass.
Yeah.
Yeah, GS Mini E bass.
Oh, was it the GS Mini? That was what it was. Yeah, I remember when they came in and they asked me to do like a video demo of it.
Sure.
And I couldn't get it to... stay in tune long enough to do a video demo of it.
Oh dear.
Just the idea of that scale length was just so short that I found it very difficult to use in sort of the application it was designed for. It just seemed like a weird thing to go for.
It's a funny scale, isn't it? Like I completely get the appeal of an acoustic bass that's more compact than your regular scale acoustic bass, because it does seem cumbersome to a lot of players, versus especially if you're used to an electric bass. But there's obviously some sweet point of getting it right in terms of the natural intonation being okay, the string gauge being appropriate to the tuners and all of the hardware and everything.
Yeah, I think, you know, from Guitar Shop days, again, like the only acoustic bass we ever seemed to sell was the Warwick Alien. Do you guys remember that?
Yeah.
You see that?
Oh, yeah, I do.
Yeah, the
Was that the Helborg signature, or that was a? It was a variation on the Helborg.
Oh, was it? I didn't realize.
I'd have to look at it. I hadn't thought about those for ages, but the Helborg signature was. Yeah, those are great. I mean, anything that Jonas has his name on, I kind of want to check out just because I'm intrigued, if nothing else. But
well,
yeah,
yes. Moving out of the Alien base before even describing it to listeners, moving into Jonas Helborg territory. Yeah, everything that guy's released has been absolutely incredible. When I was in Germany at like the first GitCon, I was there with Juan Aldrete, and Warwick were making him one of the Jonas Helborg basses, one of the signature models for him. So he was having a fretless one made with a neck pickup, and he was having his hollow. But they had there for us to check out, which both him and I were playing, was the first ever prototype of the Helborg bass, which, Naomi, have you seen the original Helborg bass?
I haven't seen it. Let me have a look.
So this is kind of like, it's like an ES-175 guitar body shape. So a big, deep, jazz-bodied guitar, but it's double cut. But it's solid. The original one was solid. So it's as thick as a jazz guitar, but completely solid. And the original one had a single jazz pickup in the bridge, and that was it. So it was it was heavy. It was something, I can't remember what they said it was, 18 pounds. Like it weighed a ridiculous amount. And then because it just had that one jazz bass pickup right in the bridge position, it was the trebliest, like mid heavy because of the wood. It was just, it was the opposite of a bass. It was like a lead bass, but it was fantastic, like a 32 inch scale. It was really cool. Like everything he did was really innovative. But even Jonas Helborg himself, after that first one, was like, yeah, maybe we shouldn't make this solid. So. The models that you buy today aren't solid. It was just that first prototype, which was cool.
Very sounds cool to check out. Highly unusual in almost every which way.
Yeah, I
quite
want
the
to,
creation.
Yeah, exactly. I keep wanting to buy one, but they're about £6,000.
God!
It's just too much to, you know, to spend on a bass that I know would only be appropriate for, like, you know, the occasional thing.
And sitting down, presumably.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, okay, so it's like, you know, I guess speaking of instruments that we'd like to get, Naomi, you've been thinking about a Chowney bass recently.
I've been shopping a little, virtually, I might add. Haven't set foot in any stores just yet. But I did get to try a bass that I'd had my eye on for a little while, which is one of the Chowney SWB1, the Scott Whitley signature short scale bass. So finally got my hands on one to try, and I'm feeling quite a lot like it's one that I'm going to add to my collection shortly. So
such an interesting company.
Yeah, right. So this particular model is clearly in the body is you know, an homage to Alembic, the sort of late 70s models that Alembic were rocking. So it's got that kind of double horn. It's got an ash body. It's got, are they angled jazz pickups?
Yeah.
They're jazz, jazz pickups, but almost like in a slotted position. And I believe they might be EMG pickups, actually.
At least on the Pro ones, I think, because there's a couple models. Because I looked at the SWB Pro a couple years ago, and I know those have, they come with they come with EMGs for that one. Because I think there's a couple ranges, but yeah, EMGs.
Sure. Yeah, but had a fairly comprehensive try of it. And tonally, it just seems like a wide palette, which is right up my street for playing across different styles, because I like to be able to play stoner rock. I like to be able to play slap. I like to be able to run through some funk bits. So I'm aware it's a big ask of any new basses I'm taking on. And it is, across the board, a beautiful instrument.
They look fantastic. They start at £530.
Yeah, and this is the model I'm looking at, is the SWB1. So it's serious bang for the buck, I can attest to. So I'll report back if I do end up picking it up, playing some shows, trying it through some different setups, because I'm
so
super
active.
Curious.
It's active as well. Mm-hmm. It's a £530 angled jazz bass pickups, active. The finishes are really cool, like a range of finishes. I thought it just came in the natural ash, because that's the one that you see it in everywhere.
Yeah, they do a few transparents as well. It's the natural ash is the one I'm likely going to be picking up, which is beautiful. They've clearly picked their pieces for each body very nicely. The few separate models I've seen have all had beautiful grain, super smart looking bass, which you'd forgive any company for potentially not doing at that price point. You know, it's not a break the bank price for a bass, but you really appreciate when within that budget the company really goes the extra mile to deliver.
Absolutely. And they do like JD said, they do the SWB Pro as well, which is only £850 in an ash and walnut, well, it's ash body again, but with a walnut top.
Yeah, that walnut top calls to me in my sleep. Like I do love a dark bass.
yeah this, it looks absolutely fantastic. I can't believe they're doing these for the price they are. And their Chowney's thing seems to be short scale though. Is that is that a company thing, or is it just that this model is that like part of their mantra?
As far as I know, I've spoken to Chowney a couple times, so like I, as far as it, it's sort of a was filling a need and seeing that there weren't a lot of variations in a short scale bass at a reasonable price point. And so basically started the company to fill that need. So it's like a lot of their stuff is like short scale, but you see like clearly the Alembic nod, and then you'll see like, you know, like Rickenbacker vibes. Or backer, depending. We can have that debate. And then, you know, you see some other stuff that are just like there's another bass that I really liked. There was a hollow body, you know, just one of the like semi acoustics that was, they're all super solid basses, like really, really great. And if you're, you know, like if you're looking at having a bunch of different kinds of basses, you know, like it's sort of nice to see that sort of stuff, especially if like short scale is your thing. It kind of feels like that's where they are.
Yeah, 100%. Has Alembic been a thing for you, Naomi? Is that why you're looking at this, or is it totally separate from that?
It is actually totally separate from that. Yeah, I've actually not got to play an Alembic just yet. Quite a few players that I've seen gigging over the years, especially kind of in some kind of heavier kind of stoner-ish bands, have been huge fans of Alembic. Definitely not that I'm not a fan, just haven't had one fall into my hands just yet. So yeah, the SWB one is coming to me from a player who picked it up and realized afterward it's a little different to what they're looking for.
Right.
Which suits me because it's a lot like what I'm looking for. So yeah, we'll see where that one goes.
Yeah, that, I'm very excited to see what happens with that. These just look like incredible quality. I'm just very excited to see an active short scale, to be honest.
Totally. Yeah, it is unusual, right? And in terms of in terms of build quality, it's I feel like I say this a lot, but it really is bang for your buck. It plays like a bass about three times its price. Super fast neck. The neck feels really slim though. It feels like you're playing kind of a chunkier jazz neck. In terms of, you know, in terms of depth, kind of like a D-shaped neck perhaps, but it's nice and narrow up around the first fret, plays super fast, set up beautifully as well. They've just really delivered on it.
And they've gone for, even on the entry level price version, they've gone for those monorail bridge pieces, so each of your strings is dealt with on its own individual bridge to, you know, to minimize string rattle moving across the other strings. I mean, you know, that's all much of a muchness as far as I'm concerned, but still it's nice to see such a premium touch on kind of something at that price point. That's very, very cool indeed.
For sure.
Now, like for home use, that is something I spoke about this on the Guitar Nerds podcast, but I wanted to mention it on the bass version as well. I recently got sent a Dark Glass Element. And I'd just like to kind of strongly recommend this to people as like a cool option for, you know, in this lockdown period where we're all stuck at home. But yeah, so Dark Glass have released their Element like a couple of weeks ago. Have either of you seen this?
I've seen it, but I don't know much about it.
No, that's...
I used to really, really like their Super Symmetry compressor, but so tell me more about this Dark Glass. I'm excited.
Well, they've released it's a headphone amp, but it's an IR loaded headphone amp.
Oh right, yes.
And it's just if you wanted some premium features, it's touch controlled, so you've got like your sort of three levels, which is your blend between your signals straight from your bass and the IR loaded headphone amplifier. You also have two headphones, so you can, you know, I guess if you want to play the person you live with some bass.
if you want to serenade your highly tolerant partner with your bass playing, yes, is exactly what you're getting at, Joe.
I can't think of that's why
okay. And that's okay.
That's it. Yeah.
Finally, we've been given the chance we've all, as bassists, hoped for.
I'm sure there is a reason, and listeners are probably sort of yelling at the podcast that I've misunderstood why there are two headphones. But I don't know why there are two headphone inputs. You can only plug in one guitar. Why would you be playing? So I don't understand. Okay, it doesn't matter. I'll leave that one. But it is incredibly cool. Comes with five different sort of IR cab simulations. So there's no like EQ or anything you can mess around with. I guess, to be honest, the sort of people that play Dark Glass are going to be playing active basses. That's not a slight. I just mean it's true. You know, people who like these sort of Apple-looking products are probably playing active guitars. But, yeah.
Speak for yourself, but okay.
that is me being prejudiced. But it comes with five sort of IR-loaded cab simulations already, and then you can change them. You can USB it in and you can switch them up on the Dark Glass website to other ones, which is really cool. It's just kind of a really advanced headphone amplifier for people playing at home. I thought, like, what a cool feature. Perfect to be released at this sort of at this time as well.
So was this released only in the last few months then, Joe?
Yeah, like two weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, sick. something like that it came out. Yeah, a really cool option. Go on, JD.
I was gonna say, what else? Like, so I'm I want to proselytize the use of you know, cab sims and everything. So I use those quite a bit if I'm trying to record, like if you're trying to record bass with distortion direct in, you know, like at, with distortion on direct into your, you know, laptop or, you know, direct into a desk, like it's, it makes so much difference to have a cab sim on there, because at least for me, I find most with most of my distortions, they sound pretty flat and terrible unless they're, you know, mic'd up through a cabinet. And so just even doing that when I'm sort of demoing stuff or just getting some sounds sort of recording with pedals into the box, like it's so, it makes such a difference and gets rid of all the sizzliness that you kind of, you can often get with distortions. So I think like, even if it's not just a headphone amp, like just thinking about it as part of your signal path from pedal board into a DI is,
yeah,
yeah, would be amazing.
Well, yeah, you can use it as long as you've got a Class D head, you can use it as a cab sim straight from there as well for either practicing or recording. And you can utilize the cab sims there, which is, a nice alternative to some of the sort of larger multi-effects pedals that will be offering you, you know, IR things, or purchasing them through your door as well. It's nice to have it kind of in like a piece of hardware. I think it's a really cool product.
Just looking at it there, Joe, are we looking at ribbon style controllers? So is it three touch strips on top?
Yeah, yeah, three.
That's
touch
super
strips.
Cool. You know what that reminds really cool. me of? It's like, I don't know if any or many listeners are familiar with the Ableton Push, but it's a beautiful piece of design on the part of software controllers. But it kind of harks to that, which is it's a cool kind of high tech nod as opposed to the knobs that we'd all be used to on pedals.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's a really nice feature. It's really interesting for a company to make a high end piece of kit out of a headphone amplifier.
Yeah,
you know.
Yes, for sure.
And I will say, I've seen this come across, you know, just various like press releases and you know, Instagram channels. Didn't realize those were anything but LEDs. I didn't realize you could actually interface with them. That's great.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very cool indeed. Now, I guess, you know, moving on, we should have a look at some questions from the Facebook group, because there were quite a few, and they're going to be pretty interesting. So we'll start off with Brandon Ivy, who's taken a photo of his favorite drive pedals, and he said, "Bass nerds, what's your favorite bass specific drive pedal?" He loves all of these. The Lucy Dreamer, which he thinks is the smoothest and most natural sounding. And then I can't see what else does he say. Oh yeah, the Pork and Pickle.
Great.
That's way huge.
Way huge, which is fantastic. The Rattler, which I don't know. The BB preamp, which I think is absolutely fantastic. Is the Rattler the one of the jam pedals? And jam pedal is obviously the, you know, an absolutely fantastic company. Mm-hmm. Who, you know, we on Guitar Nerds have had loads of time for, as they were probably the first boutique pedal brand to ever enter GAC. So that's very cool indeed. But yes. So let's talk about distortion pedals. And I guess kind of on that note, we should talk about pedal boards in general, because last week we spoke about basses and we spoke a bit about amps, but we didn't speak so much about pedal boards. So I don't really actually have any idea what either of you guys have on your pedal board. Let's talk about Naomi. Let's talk about your favorite drives first of all, but also your pedal board entire.
My pedal board entire, well, you can't see because we are remotely recording a podcast, but I'm doing the grimace that I only do as I'm just about to admit how cobbled together my not just my bass but also my pedal board is. My entire rig is some say a comedy of errors. I like to say trial and error over many, many years. But I suppose going from the drive, the kind of meat and potatoes of my board, the effect I enjoy the most certainly would be a drive, would be more so fuzz even. So I'm a bit of a fuzz aficionado.
I guess, you know, as someone who's into Doom and sludgy stuff, fuzz mm-hmm. becomes very important.
Yeah, the sludgier the better for sure. So I'm using, I'll get a picture up that I can send on maybe for the group and the socials of, it's a handmade fuzz by a gentleman called Ross Hooley, who I'm not sure is making pedals even anymore, but he has a fuzz that I bought and has really done the trick for me for quite some time. So it's a super meaty, superb low-end fuzz.
Is it based on anything?
I'm not sure entirely what it's based on, only because I bought it secondhand. So I think it's been through a few. I think it's been through a few owners before it reached me. So I don't have anything particular I can point it to as being a clone of. But a few. I mean, in terms of kind of the grit, you'd be talking like maybe like your soul food, like bass Big Muff. As a
right, so it's like old school fuzz. It's sort of flabby, floppy fuzz rather yeah. than sort of tight, gated, compressed fuzz.
Exactly. Yeah, it wouldn't be a super modern sounding fuzz. But in terms of heaviness, dirge, it ticks my boxes. Beyond that, then, and probably the pedal I've used the most in my time playing bass is an Aguilar Agro. So I know we talked in the last episode about...
Oh, you love Aguilar.
I love them. I'm a big, big Aguilar fan. So I think I mentioned before I had been playing a Tonehammer 500 for quite some time before upgrading recently to the AG750. AG700. And, of course, the Agro is based on the drive channel. The drive circuit that's within the Tonehammer 500.
Oh, is it? Oh, is that it what it is? So yeah. It's just expanded controls from, because it's just a drive control, right, on it, the Tonehammer?
Exactly, yeah, it's just a drive. You've no other parameters on the head itself. They did do the Tonehammer preamp, but I went straight from just owning the head to picking up the pedal as well, because for a long time I was playing in a grunge band that... somehow for some reason at the time it seemed to make sense to just max out the drive circuit on the head, and then I realized that this was potentially not giving me the control I perhaps desired across my pedal board. So
is it not foot switchable, the drive on the Aguilar head?
Not on the 500, no, which is a funny design piece on behalf of Aguilar, but again, I don't think every player was doing what I was doing, which is potentially not to be recommended, which was at the time maxing out the drive for each and every gig. But the as I said, the Agro remains one of my preferred drives in terms of holding on to a tight low end, providing the kind of grit and presence that certain other kind of bass drives might lack a little, or especially kind of using a bass through a guitar drive. So it kind of gives me everything across the board in terms of low end right up to high end.
It has a really interesting set of controls, like a really unconventional set of controls that make perfect sense for creating a bass drive sound, but they are very unusual.
Yeah, so it's got level, is it saturation or distortion?
Saturation.
Saturation, yeah. Then you've got your contour, which basically will... let you
so it's like new metal at one end and then yeah. sort of old school rock at the other.
Exactly. So it'll scoop at one end and it'll kind of boost your mid range at the other. So I usually have it towards the mids boost. And then you've got your presence, which I think somewhere around 2K it'll give you a boost as well.
Right, I see.
So you can kind of get super nasal and gnarly with it. I feel like I've described it as straightforward more than any other adjective. But if you're after a tube style distortion, I do still think it's a pretty kind of meat and potatoes option.
I've never tried one, but I've never even heard one. But just on the back of the control options, kind of contour and presence are exactly what I want to be able to do. I want to be able to give it like some mid focus, but I want quite a lot of presence. I want that sparkle at the 2K, and just having those controls isolated and not me trying to find them on a normal three band or something, that's sure. actually a really a really usable pedal. I need to get a hold of one of these. It looks like they're sub £200 as well. So
they are. Yeah, again,
actually great value for money. This is a great pedal. Oh. I mean, I've still not heard it, but I'm excited by it. Just off the back.
I've been saying it to everyone inside and outside of guitar stores for many, many years. And those who choose to believe me go home very happy with their with their greatly improved tone. I do think it's of a style. You know, there are more versatile pedals out there. It is a stylistic tube style distortion. But if you like the fundamental tone of this pedal, like you say, you can within that have great versatility across your.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with Plush Care. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Let's
see.
But yeah, working through the rest of my board, we've got a Boss OC2, super classic.
Oh yeah, proper classic. Do you know what year it is?
I don't know what year it is. I need to consult the people I've bought gear from in previous years. You know that because I've only increased in nerddom. I feel like in more recent times. Yes. Whereas before it was just, I hear this is cool. Here's my money. So
well, the OC2 is such an essential for bass players. The OC2 is probably the longest standing pedal on my pedal board. I managed to get I bought off of Matt Knight, one of the Guitar Nerds hosts. I managed to buy a 1984 OC2, which is. Because I have actually recently resigned it from my pedal board, but it is the 1984 OC2s were the ones that said octava instead of octave.
That was it. That was the key difference, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that was it. Just the addition of the R on the end. But just such a wonderful octave. Like, amazing that, you know, and I've been very vocal with Matt about this, that I think the OC3 isn't very good, but the OC2... In fact, like, you know, a pedal that started in the 80s and all analog octava was one of the defining pedals and one of the only octave pedals you can buy even today, still today, that tracks well for bass, like that actually tracks when you get down to the low end. And it does it because it's kind of lazy. It's not very attack driven octave. It's kind of a synthy, subby, sort of swelling in sort of. Octave, and because of that sort of natural sound that it has, it just works so well. I thoroughly recommend to listeners, you know, follow sort of, you know, Naomi and me on making that an addition to your pedal board, because they still don't go for that much money. I don't know what they go for, like £200 second.
Around 200 should get you one for sure. Yeah, which but as you say, absolutely, and as you say, I would feel very hard pushed to find a pedal to this day that would track as faithfully as the OC2.
Yeah, yeah.
But beyond that, and going delving further into sub frequencies somehow, Next in the board is my DoD Meatbox.
Oh, wow. There we go. Oh, absolutely fantastic. A Juan Alderete Essential. Is it an original Meatbox or is it the reissue?
It's not. So it's not the one with the bizarre controls that were something like, I don't know if you remember the controls on the original, but they were literally something like ham, beef chunk and some. I'm not recalling them correctly, but they were obscure. No, it is indeed the newer version.
Because it got reissued like a few years ago, right?
It did, yeah. It got reissued and got rediscontinued. So when it got rediscontinued, I said, now is my time. I should pick one up. But I saw a superb player called Neil Darrington, who plays with a band called Bark, gigging with his, and afterwards I had to go up to him and say, please, can you tell me what made that tone at about 3 minutes 15 into your third song? Because yes, I counted, because that's how good this tone sounded. And he provided some sage advice, which was to let an engineer know if you were at a sound check that you're going to be using this pedal, because it is a risky number for any nearby PA. Any unsuspecting speakers should know all about the Meatbox before it.
It is a nightclub in a pedal.
you make it sound almost kitsch, but really it is this this very serious sub-synth that means business and sounds so clean, so subtle in its frequencies while also sounding absolutely huge. So that's a super cool one.
The original ones had hit like 300 quid plus on the secondhand market. I don't know if the reissues have done that yet. I did exactly what you did, Naomi, and absolutely meant to purchase one when it got reissued, and then I didn't, and then it got discontinued, so I never actually own one. I feel terrible about that. But I've no idea if they're still affordable. Maybe I should buy one.
They definitely haven't joined the original Meatbox in price. I'm pretty sure used, you might get one in the £150 to £200 sort of range. So definitely not too high. I don't want to take up too much time talking about my board, so I'll try and get to the weird ones, which are straggling at the end. So beyond that, then, a pedal which was gifted to me a very long time ago but became useful in more atmospheric work that I did is the Electroharmonix Holy Stain, which is a combination reverb, tremolo, switchable, and a drive, has a drive and fuzz option within. The drive and fuzz within the Holy Stain sound absolutely meaty. They sound mental. And then combine that with the rumor hall reverb and you've got a pretty wonderful drone sound. So I feel like it's a slightly lesser known electroharmonics pedal, and especially to bassists.
For sure, yeah.
Yeah, but it's proven sufficiently weird and wacky to get me through some big and slow riffs.
Yeah, I guess reverb's kind of an essential on bass then for big sludge things. Like it's one of the effects I've had the least committed to my board, but is it
sure?
Is it do you think it's is it an essential?
Well, technically speaking, I mean, many years ago the small bit of kind of college training I did was in audio, and you know, you're kind of told that bass and reverb can be a little bit chalk and cheese just because of the lower notes potentially garbling a reverb effect when they process. But in terms of kind of more atmospheric, I mean, even into kind of post-rock and stuff like that, the things you can do in the higher register, especially on your D and G strings with reverb, are really, really scenic and really quite brilliant in terms of, as I said, creating drones or creating any number of kind of more spacey effects. So in the case of the Holy Stain, I would say it's not the most straightforward reverb pedal, in that it's you know, it's quite stylistic. The controls are quite general, because outside of the drive and fuzz options, you literally have room, you have hall, you've tremolo, and you actually have a pitch shift on there, which can bring you up or down two tones. I believe so. It's it's an unusual beast. I feel like electroharmonics are quite good at creating those, especially when they combine effects. But yeah, the things, as I said, I've used it for have been kind of big squealing, very long sustained notes. And then in the lower end, just super big drones.
I see. And does the reverb complete your board? Is that your
the
last
reverb,
thing?
The very last that has been on there for some gigs has been the Canyon, also by Electroharmonics.
Oh, really? The Canyon delay. What a fantastic delay pedal. One of my absolute favourites.
I know,
so versatile.
Right?
So versatile.
Yeah, so a much more recent edition. I think, did it come out in 2017 or 2018?
I think it was 2018. Actually, a couple of podcasts ago, we were talking about the fact that, you know, again, back at GAC, we were trying to record soundscape, like film scores as videos. And we were doing things like the theme from Interstellar or from Blade Runner. And I had to build and recreate that sound with a looper and loads of pedals. And the Canyon was an absolute go-to because it was just so versatile.
Right. Mm-hmm. So they nailed it, I have to say, design-wise. The Canyon straight out the box. I was in a store at the time when it came out, and I remember sitting down to give it a quick try. I'm pretty sure it was like closing in sort of to Christmas time. And I remember thinking, this is going to be super popular. The layout, everything about it, the controls are so simplistic. All you've got is you've got your effects level, you've got your delay, you've got your feedback. Everything is tappable. And then beyond that, you've got tons of modes. So in terms of the stuff I've done, it would have been kind of my own sort of electro compositions, I guess, with bass. And I do quite a lot with the shimmer mode, with the octave mode. So you get this cool kind of almost Eventide-esque octave delay. And yeah, that's been about it. That really is more kind of a, I suppose, an artistic tool than a kind of fundamental tone tool, of course. But in terms of an easy to use delay as a first delay, perhaps, I couldn't recommend it more. They've obviously since then brought out the Grand Canyon, which kind of follows the design a little more of the, you know, the Memory Man kind of more classic reverb layouts in terms of kind of connectivity as well. But the original Canyon, the OG Canyon, if you like, is nice, small footprint, super neat, super well designed.
Yeah, and not a lot of money as well, like £120, £130, something like that. Like, yeah, super affordable for, you know, such an incredible pedal. Yeah, yeah, it's very cool.
Yeah, but thus concludes my board currently. Oh, there's lots. I'm certain there's lots of interesting bits that I'm forgetting about that I'll be sure to interrupt you both with in future episodes.
Well, I'm sure we could and should do, you know, episodes on bass drive, which is probably the most, you know, sort of contested kind of thing. So much more than the guitar drive, I think. There's so much more to bass drive and what makes a good one and a bad one and what works and what doesn't. Certainly for me, it's the effect that I have changed out, you know, it's countless times in search of the right one. So I think there's a lot of kind of discussion there. But JD, we should talk about you and your literal boxes of pedals.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's probably an entire month or two of podcast, but
we should start maybe by trying to answer Brandon's question before we move into the rest of your board.
So. I am on it. I'm going to talk about drives right here.
So
what I was going to say about that is that drive is one of the things that it's probably the thing that I'm fussiest about, that and octaves. But with drives, I, like Naomi, I'm much more into the more vintage style fuzz, like analog, just big woolly walls of sound. Like I don't really play the new modern style gated fuzz that much. Like I keep really trying to, and it just never really sticks.
Yeah, but I can imagine that. It's a difficult thing to find tonally for bass.
Yeah, and I think, like, I just don't play in groups where it would make sense. Yeah, you know, and like I do a lot of my own stuff, and it's never really felt right for me. But so I usually have at least at least 4 different drives on my board. And I think now what I actually have on my board is the Way Huge Pork and Pickle, which is great because it's got just drive and fuzz on it. And I really like the fuzz on that one as far as it not being necessarily too boutique-y or and the fact that like I could pick that pedal up, you know, wherever if I needed to, like if something happened to mine. So it's you know, like I can go to most cities will have a shop that will have Way Huge that you can just get, you know, if mm-hmm. needs be, again, when that was a thing. But really my favorite distortion I use the most, that one, the Harmonic Percolator, is the, and I have one of the old 70s ones. So
what?
Yeah. You've seen this.
Oh yeah. I do know this. Yeah.
yeah. So I have one of the old Harmonic Percolators.
It goes around the wrong way.
Yeah. It's so good. And that one I really like because it's so versatile. Like you can get it with just a tiny, tiny bit of breakup, or you can just go into pretty much sheer nonsense in a way, and it gets really gainy and noisy and trebly, and it's so fun to work with, like that level of chaos that you can get, like in very, very shellac style or very, you know, anything like that. But I mean, Billy Gibbons plays one. Steve Albini, like Bob Weston from Shellac, play them. You know, like it's pretty out there as far as, you know, like the range you can get.
Do you find it difficult to use the percolator without a blend?
Well, it depends. So I sort of have a love-hate relationship with blends. Like I thought everything should have a blend for a long time just to keep everything like subtle. Like if needed, because it's with bass especially, it's so important to keep the low end and to keep the cleanliness of the low end, so to be able to articulate, because otherwise it just gets lost, which is great if you are trying to do that, but when you're not trying to lose it, like that's why gated fuzz is a thing, right? So you can still like stop the note when you want to stop the note, and also hear just sort of what pitch it actually is. Like that's, I don't really find, cause I use it kind of like in a middle range. So it still shines through my bass. Like I still feel there's enough fundamental there. Plus I have a couple different setups. So I had like JHS years and years and years ago made me a custom pedal that is basically a clean blend. So I can run my signal in, and then I have a couple loops that now there are utility pedals that do this, but it's, you know, I can run everything through. I have an effects loop blend, so I can blend all of it. And but usually the effects that like swallow up my low end, I'll put through that part of my sends so that I can blend in those pedals if I do want some clean sound.
Right.
But I mean, I think it's always useful to have a blend. I think it's great, and I usually kind of have a bit of clean, so like that Way Huge has that on it. I haven't found it to be difficult, but I'm usually using it at times where it doesn't matter that there's not a clean bass signal below it, you know, so because if not I would do another pedal that kind of does something, which is why I have multiple drive pedals on my board.
Okay.
All the time. So the other pedal that I've just picked up in the last year or so, that I quite like is a Tube Screamer, but it's the one with, and let's get over debates about, you know, about IC chips. but the Tube Screamer, it's the new Tube one that has that, like,
oh, really? Like you bought valve. the white Tube Screamer.
Yeah. And so I have that and I quite like it because it gives you a couple more options for a Tube Screamer, and it gets like pretty, it sounds just like a classic Tube Screamer, but it also has a blend, and you can also sort of like over gain it in a way.
You can like collapse the front end and make it all fuzzy.
Yeah. Yeah. And so it's like, it gets pretty good. And that's, I use that if I want just a kind like, you know, like a bit of breakup. So if I'm playing like a slightly dirtier line than, you know, let's say a big woolly wall of sound kind of thing. And then my other sort of, like at the moment, kind of normally distortion I have is the MXR bass distortion that I quite like, which was, I believe that's the one that Ryan from Fuzzrocious helped design.
Oh, really? I didn't realize he'd helped design that. Sorry,
yeah, I'm
Ryan.
Pretty sure it's that one. I know he did with one. Maybe it's separate, but yeah, I know. He had done some stuff, and that one's just really great. It's I actually played that when I was over a few years ago. I did a show with Steve Lawson, and I just asked him because I knew he has probably 30 pedals with him at all times. certainly back, even if he's not playing. And so, like, I asked him if I could borrow that one, because they had just come out then. And so I played the show with that pedal, and I really liked it. And he was like, "Oh, I'll you know, give it to you." And he actually just gave me that one last January for this NAMM. So I have the pedal I played a few years ago now. So it's
awesome.
Yeah. So it's which is great, and it's like a really good versatile distortion that, you know, gives you a lot of different sonic range. But as far as my favorite, I mean, I don't know. I have some very special memories of a very special, like, a couple different 70s or different eras of Big Muffs that I've had over the years that, like, again, those are, there's just some, they just weren't quite white, so I shifted them on and then got, it's a never ending quest to find the right fuzz. But, like, I've been pretty pleased with that Pork and Pickle. As far as, like, having an idea of, like, what if I just had one distortion / fuzz on my board, which I haven't had since, I don't know, the 90s.
And so, it's hard.
Yeah,
know.
It's just, I just like so many different things. I like them to do what they're best at, and I like all the different shades of it. So in that sense, like, I always have a handful of distortion sort of drives on my board. And then just a couple quick topics I think we can, like, sort of highlight, because my board is ever evolving, and, you know, like, I don't have necessarily at the moment, like, all the weird stuff in front of me, but massively into octaves. The two or three octaves that have been on my board. So the OC, the Boss OC, I can't remember if I had an OC2 a long time ago, and I thought it was right, but I never really got on with the synthiness, or, like, there was, like, for me, it never really tracked as well as I wanted to. So likely it sounds like the OC3 is what I've been playing, but mm-hmm. There's something, like, it still always sounded a little fakey to me. And I like, right. So I have my favorite octave is my 70s Mutron octave divider.
Nice.
Which is great. Which is, I think it is the epitome of what I like in an octave sound, where it's just an analog signal. It breaks up, it's got the octave up, like, ringer effect as well, like, you can, it can do so much, and it sort of, it tracks chords, I'll say, well, but, like, it sounds really musical when you track the chord, because it's not a direct harmonization, it's the octave below the sum of what you're playing, so it's just still sort of, it just puts a lower note below what you're doing, and it's really great and musical, and, like, it, the octave sound itself sounds great. So I have that pedal, which doesn't really go out very often because it's older than I am and finicky. Yeah. and a beast to repair. So I have a clone of that I built probably 10 years ago. And then I also have probably the pedal that's been on my board the longest is a mid-90s EBS octave pedal. So the octave bass. So it's nice. The old gray one where the inputs are switched basically the wrong way around. So it works great with a harmonic percolator. actually, those are at the top and on the back. But still, like, it's... Yeah, it's like one of those... Like, it had always been, like, sideways on my board so that I could have patch cables going correctly. And then it's... But, like, that one... I think I've made one repair to it since, yes, for the in the last 20 years that I've had it, and I just had to replace the Switch, which you probably assume after 20 years, and it's had, you know, beer spilled on it at, you know, from some guy in the front row at some show, and it's had like all this, and it's there, it tracks so well, and it sounds so good. It's the closest Mutron sounding octave I've had, and it's also like just smoother, like it's its own flavor, but it's that
right,
vibe,
still
but like
the same
smoother
voice.
Yeah,
that sounds cool. I'd be super keen to try one of those out, because I agree with what you're saying. The OC2, OC3 do add that sort of synthy vibe to what they offer in terms of the octave effect, don't they? So this sounds like it's that bit more fundamental, super simple, does what it says on the tin.
Yeah. I haven't really played the new ones much, so I'd like to check those out. But I'm also like, now I'm feeling like I should probably give like the synthy vibes another go, because I also do a lot of synth stuff. Like, it's just
I will stand by the OC2 as being sort of the most musical octave I've ever played. We do different things, I guess, on the bass. But the OC2 definitely for anyone who's thinking about getting into octave, I think maybe you use octave a lot more than I do. I think if you're looking for a simple, very effective pedal that sounds very good at giving you an octave underneath everything that you're doing, with the option of a second octave underneath, which doesn't really track at all, but there will be some presence of something rumbly happening, then there's nothing better than an old 80s OC2, and they're still very affordable. But yes, of course, I agree, the Mutron, it absolutely a kind of holy grail of octave pedals.
The other thing is they are, so Mutron is like Musictronics is back, I think that's the name of the company, but they are making them
again.
They are
back.
And I think the octave dividers are out, so I'm pretty sure, because I've tried all of them. And if they sound anything like it, it's certainly worth doing. And I think I'm probably going to end up picking up one of the modern ones just for ease of use and also real estate, because, you know, the octave divider I have it's bigger than the new small, you know, like 808s that like Roland has. And so it's like I could have a drum machine on my board or an octave pedal. And then just quickly, I have an old envelope is big for what I do. So I have a
envelope filter is a thing for you.
Yeah. And I mean, and I use it a lot with distortion, usually just because I think there are certain distortions that work really well with it, like the MXR, and also the harmonic percolator, but I really like the MXR with an envelope because it just like really makes it pop. And not necessarily in like a funk way, but just in like one of those sort of, I don't know, Coheed Cambria-ish, like weird bass popping out of a mix kind of ways every once in a while.
Is that a way it can work? Maybe envelope's something I need to get into. I always write it off because I think of it as a funk utility.
Yeah, it's really interesting because you can do so much with it. So it's really about how it plays with other pedals for me. Whereas, like, you know, I have friends that certainly like probably have an envelope filter on the entire time they're playing. And, you know, like, it'd be like watching your, you know, someone you've known always wear glasses, and then all of a sudden they don't wear glasses anymore. You know, they stop using
your glasses. I've always felt of it as like a, I felt of envelope filters the same way I kind of feel about slap playing, is like it's a fantastic cover up for not doing very much.
That is a hot take. there are excellent players out there who showcase the filter effect for what it can really add to one's playing, perhaps.
You are of course absolutely right, and it is
a diplomat, though.
It's an incredibly biased opinion, but yeah, I sort of I think it was
with Naomi's.
Thanks, JD. That's cool.
It was one of those things where I think I was like, man, what those people are doing is incredible. When I sort of saw like slap players with envelope filters for the first time, and then you sort of learn to play bass, and I was like, oh, you mean it's just you're just moving a bar chord hand shape around,
yeah,
with an envelope filter. Oh, right. I thought there was a thing going on here that I couldn't do. That's kind of my opinion of it, but I appreciate I'm incredibly critical of funk bass. Well, because I don't know.
Tell me in sincerity that you cannot say the same of distortion and drive and delay and let's see what else.
Oh no!
I'm not going to say all effects.
The floor.
I'm not going to say all effects, but all that's coming to mind is. And only because it's specifically a delay distortion thing. But if anyone out there has seen the wonderful comedian Bill Bailey and the sketch he did, which was quite a good impersonation of The Edge. And then the idea is that The Edge's board gets disconnected and the clean tone is all that's left. And he's playing
Three Blind Mice.
Yeah. It's definitely a nursery rhyme. And it really was an interesting comment on instrumental society, let's say. But
you're definitely right. Yeah, I totally appreciate that. I think it was just that it fooled me. You're absolutely right. I guess that everything is a cover up of something. But I think for me, for the longest time, the envelope filter slap playing fooled me into thinking there was this higher echelon of bass playing. And then when I realized what the trick was, I was like, oh, that's the same as what everyone's doing.
There's absolutely some truth to that, I think. I mean, you know, even the likes of Thundercat, like I'm not sure if Thundercat plays much without his envelope filter on, for example. And I mean, I'd be a fan of his music. Absolutely not everyone is. It's quite a specific style. But I suppose there's the distinction between an effect being a tool and an effect being a crutch, maybe is what you're getting at.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, sorry. Yeah. I've been railroading your talk of envelope filters, JD.
Well, I think you know, if there's something if envelope filters are something you want to get into, I would say, like, for me, I'm as fussy about them as I am like distortions and such, where I really want like an old school vintagey sounding envelope, and I really want like specific controls around range and like resonance and stuff, because it's, you really have to dial it in for it to be good. And there's so many envelopes out there that I just don't get on with. I don't really like their I don't really like, or they'll have like one specific purpose, and I kind of play, again, like more of a Mutron background. So like the one I have is probably early 80s or whenever this, one of the early Qtrons from Electro Harmonix, which again, Mike from Musictronics designed. And you know, so it's a Mutron circuit just in those. And it's one of the big old, you know, that's, you know, one of the size of a shed boxes and everything, and looks super cool and trippy artwork wise but I really like it. It's really like analoging. It feels like there's an interaction with it, whereas like I also have other envelopes that are like really modern and are really like really pitchy on the high end, like they're really sort of thin and peaky, and which can have its place, and it's stuff I like to use with distortions, because it really sort of like the upper harmonics really sort of clang through in a way that you don't get on like some of the older, warmer, vintager, bubblier kind of envelopes. But moving on from sort of envelope checks, otherwise that's another episode probably. the other sort of two big ones that I use is using this too, like I think it's an 83 Boss CS2, the compressor sustainer.
Which
is not in any way a subtle compressor, like that Dark Glass Supersymmetry that I mentioned before, or to tie it back to Aglar as well, their TLC compressor, which I really like. Both of those are like clean, useful compressors for like like the TLC especially is just like a studio compressor for me.
For sure. And then, super transparent.
Yeah, and it's super, super great responsive. And I think the slopes is it's a 2-something to 1. I pull that out from nowhere. That super symmetry was just super smooth and great too. But this compressor sustainer, the CS2, is I use it 100% for an effect, just really bringing out like all the string noise, bringing out all the harmonics, bringing out like everything.
Exactly what Juan Aldrich uses his for, just for all those harmonics on a fretless bass. And that's what that CS2 is perfect for, is that.
Yeah. And there was a man who told me to get one mostly for that purpose, and his name you've already said a couple of times, so I don't want to do it again, because although I hope he's doing well, because he is amazing and one of the nicest dudes I've ever met. And then I'll close it out with yet another Boss product, the RE-20. I say dash 20 because I'm speaking into an RE-20 Electro Voice microphone right now.
My favorite microphone.
I really, really like it. It's what I record bass with. It's my main bass amp mic that I've been recording for 10 years with. It's the mic I've used almost exclusively.
I actually think it's great for absolutely everything.
Yeah.
It's a total all-rounder. I mean, you sound absolutely like you're speaking into a vocal mic right now, and you're literally saying it's the same mic that you've trusted to record bass cabs for a long time. Yeah. That's testament to an all-rounder mic.
Yeah, and my voice is as tinny as Jay's is, which we all know is shrill. It's great. There was some video I was watching recently, some like late 70s. It's probably a Jaco. I think it is a Jaco video when it goes and it shows like the horn section, and they all have like RE-20s like in front of the trombones and like everything. And you're just like, yep, that's a microphone they're miking trombone with. It's one of the two broadcast microphones that everyone uses.
It's Tom York's microphone of choice for every situation.
Is it?
Yeah.
Didn't know that.
There you go.
Well, great.
Further testament.
Yeah.
So back to my pedal board. The Boss. So the Boss RE-20 Space Echo is my favorite delay/reverb that I've used for, I think, roughly since it came out, so which was what, late 20?
I'm not sure. Was it even 20?
It was 2005, 7, 9?
It's got to be one of, no, it's got to be like 2002, 3, 4, something like that. Oh, maybe that 5 at the latest. I think it might be one of the longest running, Boss double pedals, like that. They've discontinued so many of those.
I mean, it's been on my board since then, whenever that was. And, most things that come and go. And like, I have a love hate relationship with sort of delays and reverbs too. And where I just get so picky with them. And reverb is such a tricky thing to really get right. Also with my style of playing is like a lot of it's very like solo-y sounding. So I could do a lot of guitar stuff, and plus there's so much on the market now that's really great. It's just kind of hard to find the right one, and I haven't really sat down and like put a Strymon and stuff on my board, but there's so much stuff that sounds great. It just doesn't really fit my very particular niche vibe that I want, or I haven't found a way to like interact with it in the same way. Like I'm just not vibing with a pedal, and then it becomes a thing that it's like, oh, I'm just using reverb to use reverb versus I'm using it as a tool to enhance what I'm doing.
I think we'll talk about on future podcasts, there is a big difference between a pedal being good and a pedal being good for bass.
Very true.
it's such a more specific thing that it's taken me years to understand that it's such a more specific thing, because I get, I buy into every bit of hype that ever is, you know, that's ever out there about any brand, and I buy all the pedals, and then I try and play them being a bass player rather than a guitarist, and there's so much stuff that just doesn't gel. It's such a different kettle of fish, but you know, I'm sure we will talk about that on future podcasts. I think the drive discussion definitely needs to continue, and of course on this we are over time actually for this week's episode of the Bass Guitar Nerds podcast, and we barely answered a single question, which is exactly the same as the Guitar Nerds podcast. I'm glad to see nothing is different on this. We're always gonna just go off on weird tangents, but there's so much to talk about when it comes to bass drives, and there are so many things out there. And listeners, I'd love for us all to talk about our experience with different drives, you know, throughout the years, and kind of help you maybe sort of narrow down future purchases for drive pedals for bass, because for me it is absolutely that's the number one hardest thing, harder than basses, than amps, and anything else, is nailing the correct drive pedal. And it is something that I've been searching for and still really haven't found my end game for. So I'd, you know, that can be a journey that we all take together. But that is pretty much it for this week's episode of the Bass Guitar Nerds podcast. We'll be back the week after next with another episode of the Bass Guitar Nerds podcast. So thank you very much for tuning in. You can, of course, check out Guitar Nerds on any of the major social platforms with @GuitarNerds, or check out our Patreon on patreon.com/GuitarNerds. And we'll be back next week with more of this guitar nerdery. Farewell.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.